You're very welcome back to The Late Debate, and we're on the telly tonight as well. We're broadcasting live on RTE News Now, so have a peek at us if you want. We're discussing our health service again tonight, and specifically the apparent lack of junior doctors in our hospitals. These doctors are called non-consultant hospital doctors, or NCHDs, and they have roles up to registrar level before reaching the top of their game to become a consultant. But a number of factors, most particularly it seems money, is encouraging medical graduates to leave Ireland rather than stay and work in hospitals here. So tonight we're discussing the reasons, the impact and the effect on patient care, and what can be done to reverse the problem. And with me in studio tonight are Professor Orla Hardiman, consultant neurologist at Beaumont Hospital in Dublin, NCHD Hugh Adler, who's based in the Mater Hospital, Fine Gael TD Dr Liam Toomey, who's also a GP, and medical writer Priscilla Lynch. We did ask for the chief executive of the HSE. He wasn't available. Neither were the health minister, James Riley, nor his junior minister, Alex White. So you're all very welcome to the programme. Hugh, first of all, you are an NCHD in the Mater.
Yes.
Why are you still here?
That's a very good question. It's something I've noticed. So many people from my class, I graduated 3 years ago, and so many of my friends and classmates have gone to Australia and New Zealand and are staying there, whereas back when I was in college, that many people had a plan to go for a year, to go away and travel, but then come back. But more and more people are staying away. People would stay for family reasons. We have roots here, we have family and friends here, but certainly working conditions in Ireland over the past number of years compared to working conditions elsewhere have really driven this exodus, as you said, of non-consultant hospital
doctors. And are there many vacancies in the Mater as we approach the changeover of July 7th?
I think we'll only really know on July 7th. I know that we're looking at least 200 vacancies at non-consultant level all over the country, but probably smaller hospitals, emergency departments will be hit the most hard. Certainly, I know that the emergency department in the Mater is missing a few people already. And we'd hope that we can fill as many of those vacancies as possible before July, because if not, then services will be even more stretched than they already are, and that's a real worry.
Well, exactly, and we'll talk about the impact on patient care in a few moments. But Orla Hardiman, you're at the Beaumont Hospital in Dublin. What's the situation like there?
I mean, I think as Hugh says, I mean, this is a problem. It's a perennial problem. You know, we've always had an issue of young doctors emigrating out of Ireland. I mean, I'm qualified 31 years this year, and I emigrated in 1986, and as did all of my the vast majority of my classmates in the last crisis that we had in the health system. So it's not a new problem, and I think we need to take a much longer view about what the issues are. Clearly, there are very tangible effects, and we really need to discuss those. But the issues are around, why do people go and why do people stay? And they're about infrastructure and about career progression and about quality of life. I think the issue in Beaumont, to answer your question, is probably similar to the Mater. It's hard to say. My own discipline in neurology, we're very lucky in that we will have a full complement of staff, but then we are in a tertiary referral hospital, and I think it's probably the smaller hospitals and the regional hospitals that are hurting most in this regard. But that really is a reflection of the horrible structure that we have within our hospital system, that it's almost impossible to get people who have any sort of ambition at all to stay. And that's really something we should discuss.
Priscilla, Orla said there, it's not a new problem. Medics have always left at some point in their career, early on in their career. But why are we being told it's such a crisis now?
Because they're not coming back, and frankly they're leaving at an earlier stage and going away for longer periods and claiming that they're never going to come back at all. We're also having to recruit doctors from abroad, which was a case we didn't have to do 10 years ago to staff the Irish health system. We have a lot of non-EU doctors who work very hard and diligently in our hospital system, who've always been part of it, but now we're actually actively recruiting from countries such as Pakistan, where we've recently recruited 112 NCHDs to come and fill these posts in July that will be coming vacant. We're also recruiting from Eastern Europe, and we also recruited last year from India as well in the last couple of years, which didn't particularly work out that well in regards to visas. So it is something that's been there for a long time, and Irish doctors do go abroad to train, which is actually excellent for the health system. They get experience in some of the best centres in the world, and they come back like Orla here. But the problem is just trying to get them back. And there are some doctors who they're at a senior part of their career now in America and other countries, who would be fantastic additions to our health service, but who are not coming back actually at the moment due to a variety of reasons, particularly the working conditions and the pay structure here at the moment.
We'll delve into that in a little more detail as well. But Liam Toomey, I want to talk to you with your GP hat on rather than your political hat for the moment, at least. You're concerned at the quality of the medical care then that's in our hospitals as a result of the lack of NCHDs.
I qualified in 1993, and I think there was a report done 4 years before that, which is around 25 years ago, which showed that in some of the hospitals outside of the Cork and Dublin, up to 70% of the doctors working there were non-Irish graduates. So they were mainly from Pakistan and India. And with huge numbers of the senior positions filled, and I'm not talking about consultants, just below consultants, were positions that were filled by Indian and Pakistani doctors mainly. When you moved into the cities like Cork and the university hospitals, there was hardly anybody from those countries working there. And we seem to put up with that situation for years where we didn't have a problem exporting our own doctors. There was something supposed to be done about it when we published two reports, one on undergraduate training and one on postgraduate training. And very little of those recommendations have been implemented over the last number of years, over 20 years. And I think the crisis now that we have at the moment is basically throwing up those problems in a way that is really detrimental for patient care. And yes, I think as a GP and speaking to colleagues of mine who are GPs, they speak about it anecdotally, and these will not be the big hospitals now, but maybe some of the smaller hospitals, that at a time when a patient was admitted to hospital and seen and discharged 4 or 5 days later, we were comfortable that everything was done. But now if a patient presents themselves back to the surgery after discharge, a day or two within discharge, you haven't quite got the same confidence that everything was, you know, that maybe that the patient was managed in a way that you would be comfortable with.
Can I comment on that? Because I think there's two things we need to be very careful about here. I mean, there's nothing wrong with people from other countries coming to work in Ireland. Problem is, and many of the people that I work with are not Irish, and they're superb. So let's just make that clear. The second thing is, I mean, I think you're right, Liam. This is a lack of joined up thinking, which started way before even I started medical school, and long before you did. I mean, if you look at what happened, actually, just I've been in the system quite a long time, and when we were appointing doctors, maybe consultants, maybe 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, there was money in the system, and there was an active suppression on non-consultant hospital doctor posts. There were fewer posts for NCHDs because there was an expectation that the consultant numbers would increase. Mm-hmm. So there's an expansion of consultants, but without any recognition of the infrastructure or support that are required to do this. So the system was still predicated on having lots and lots of junior doctors and then consultants sort of overseeing things. But yet the junior hospital doctors were culled in a way, and the consultant numbers were increased. And at the same time then, we began to hit a rocky course financially, and the so-called frontline staff were so-called preserved, and the infrastructure in the hospital was within the hospital system primarily was gradually eroded. And we're at a point really now where that's actually at serious crisis level. There's a massive dearth of clerical support staff in the hospital system, which is really grinding the hospital to a halt, which is a lot of what you're describing in terms of what happens to your patients afterwards. So then there was a recognition that actually we had culled the NCHD numbers too much because we ran into problems with the European Working Time Directive. Now, we've known about the European Working Time Directive, which is that you can't work over a certain number of hours. So many years, but the health system, the Department of Health, the Health Service Executive, decided to ignore that. So we had a smaller number of junior hospital doctors working longer hours because there weren't enough of them, because the system hadn't sufficiently changed. And then that their sort of the quality of work declined, the requirement of the work increased. And then there's a recognition that actually, and also we had targets generated by the HSE, so we had to generate these PTLs, they're called, which is the number of patients you have to see. Okay. So there's an increased pressure, the hospital being fined for not meeting the targets, and also the countries being fined by Europe for not complying with the European Working Time Directive. So then there's a recognition, well, we have to increase the number of junior hospital doctors again to reflect the problems of the European Working Time Directive. And that's happened in the last year or so. So we've had an expansion. But we're having great difficulty filling the posts because all of Hugh's friends have emigrated, because it's much nicer to work in other Anglophone countries such as Australia.
They also seriously lack the career structure that gives them the confidence to stay working there.
Well, that goes back to the lack of joined up thinking, because, you know, that's just an example of our manpower. That's nothing, you know, that's a poor joined up thinking. even in really basic things like how many consultants do we need per specialty? How, you know, I mean, we're a small country, 4.5 million. It's not exactly rocket science to figure out how many doctors we need to give an adequate level of care. We haven't been able to do that. We've been footering around, changing the numbers of house staff. A lot of this is sort of small political. It's, individuals with a little bit of power, you know, meeting, delivering out little presents of yes or no, you can have this or you can't have that. This is in the old structures.
Hugh Adler, Hugh, just tell us why you believe your colleagues are leaving.
Yeah, well, I think a bit part of it goes back to what Prof Hardman was saying about the about joined up thinking that we've known about these problems for so long. So it's nothing new. It's working hours, the number of hours people are required to work, the career structure they perceive, the fact that our training system requires people to move over the country as opposed to staying in the one hospital. And so, and I mean, the fact that, we have doctors coming from outside of Ireland, outside the EU, is a great thing. I've been mentored by some incredible doctors who weren't from Ireland, but.
But the working time directive, has that been sorted? I mean, what are your hours?
My hours, at the moment I work in ICU, so I work a maximum of a 24-hour shift, and that compares to when I was doing general medicine, I was working 36-hour shifts. And it's really, the implementation of European working time directive has been piecemeal. It varies by what grade you are, what specialty you are, and what hospital you are. And while some hospitals for some specialties have brought in fully compliant rosters, other hospitals, again, particularly the smaller hospitals, don't have the staffing levels, a combination of lack of staffing levels, lack of willpower.
So the directive is being breached?
Mm-hmm. On a daily basis.
Priscilla, you wanted to?
Yeah, I just have a bit of an update on the European Working Time Directive there. We might just recall back in October there was a massive strike by junior doctors due to the non-implementation of the directive. It should be pointed out we were the only country in Europe, bar Greece, who didn't implement the directive. And there was a lot of work done before it actually came in, practicing rosters and everything. So it was absolutely a disgrace. But since then, there has been a lot of progress. And I know that according to the Irish Medical Organisation, though, they've said this week that progress has slowed down. They agreed a deal with the HSE last year that it would be fully compliant by the end of this year, and while things started off well, things have slowed down again. So this is obviously not very appealing to NCHDs who are out there who've been waiting and waiting for years. They're not working shifts that are longer than 24 hours as far as I know in most cases, but again, they've gone abroad. But this was a big actually reason for some of them going abroad. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have young families, and I just think the appetite isn't there either anymore. There's been an increased change, I suppose, in attitudes even of doctors themselves about what they're willing to work. They're willing to work incredibly hard, but at the cost of their families, their health, their lifestyles. No, when they see other countries where they can have a balance, a better balance.
I think it's more to do with the quality of the work and the quality. I mean, I worked in the States, and you work very hard as a junior doctor in the States as well. You work really, really hard. But there's an end point in sight, and there's a recognition that some of the work that you do is learning. That's the difference.
Yes.
So the system that we have in Ireland is essentially an apprenticeship system. So the more you see, the more you learn. And we don't really, as Hugh was saying, the career structure is such that there isn't one. It's such that, you know, that you ascend in your the years postgraduate training by just seeing more and more patients. But we haven't built in a structure of sort of appropriate seniority, appropriately elevated levels of responsibility, and appropriate downtime and thinking time. That's perceived within the HSE, I think, as probably being sort of wasted time. Mm-hmm. And so bodies on the wards, bodies in NE, bodies in clinic is what's required. And that really isn't very conducive to learning. You learn to some extent, but you can continuously make the same mistakes. But if you're not provided with any sort of appropriate mentorship or learning within the system.
Well, we can hear some experiences of two NCHDs in terms of the working time directive. This was them telling Primetime last year about the effect the long hours have had on their work.
I remember one specific incident where I got called by a nurse to come and see a patient who needed a line put in. It was something minor, but I actually could not go. I was that tired. I was rooted to the spot. You're just physically drained, exhausted. You can't actually move.
I think I've undoubtedly suffered adverse mental health outcomes. They stem from the fact that on one occasion I almost killed a patient. I had been working for 13 days almost in a row in a hospital, and I had only been out of the hospital for maybe 8, 9, 10 hours at most. And at that time, I had given the wrong medication to a patient, and it took me about 2 or 3 minutes to realise I had made the mistake. But luckily, I was able to reverse it and the patient suffered no ill outcome. But to think of the responsibility that I came that close to killing that lady takes its toll on you, do you know?
Well, I'm sure it does. Hugh, does that sort of thing still happen, that pressure and those hours and the impact of those hours?
I think the important thing is that people are finally realised that these were are the conditions under which junior doctors are working. The fact that we're talking about it, the fact that we're having this debate and everyone has this level of knowledge and is on the same page, and that's a really positive thing. And things that mean safeguards are being put in place, even apart from the European Working Time Directive, when it comes to errors, any kind of medical error, in terms of wrong medications. We have a lot more safeguards in place now.
But those experience there, would that still happen? Would you be that tired, that exhausted?
I mean, friends of mine have crashed their cars on the way home from, several different friends of mine have crashed their cars on the way home from night shifts, without doubt. I mean, I get the bus home. I routinely fell asleep on the bus home on the way post-call, and I'd wake up miles past my stop. That level of tiredness, it's no laughing matter, and it's a real problem.
And it's still happening. Mm. So Liam Toomey, I mean, so the European Working Time Directive is being consistently breached, it seems.
Absolutely. I was supposed to be one of the first doctors working in this country under the European Working Time Directive when I qualified in 1993. So it has been just postponed and postponed and postponed. We have a problem, you see, in this country where it's that young doctor who makes the mistake is wrong and will be the one who will be sanctioned by the medical council when something goes wrong. And then it jumps right up then to the Minister for Health. And it seems that everybody else in between, it's a systems error. And until we have such a situation where everybody takes responsibility right up the line, in the 20 years, we should have the European Working Time Directive brought in. We should have career structures where someone like Hugh, when he qualifies, can get a job like they have in the UK, where he actually knows what he's going to be doing for the next 5 years, not the next 5 months. And we've absolutely failed miserably. And even when we were going to India and Pakistan and Sudan and trying to steal doctors from third world countries, essentially, we should have realised we're in a serious crisis here. But it doesn't seem to dawn on the HSE or what exactly is going on here. And I it actually does make me angry because we're so long talking about this. And I think it is actually now at a point where everybody, I think to some degree, those of us who went through the system a bit faster, like say when I qualified, established my practice, we kind of forgot about junior doctors. Consultants were the same. They worked their backsides off as junior doctors. We did 72-hour shifts. And then we come out the other end, you get your consultancy, and you kind of feel, well, that's not really my issue. And there's a bit of that. I'm not saying I'm not accusing consultants as a group, but there is a bit of the, you know, we're all macho in this game.
I think the problem is actually it's really that it's reactive. We have a very reactive system. Yeah. The European Working Time Directive, you know, as Liam said, has been around for a long time, but it was a reaction to implement it. It wasn't really integrated into reform within the system in general. It was a reactive response, like I was saying, we had too many NCHDs and we had too few NCHDs. Now we need more NCHDs because the European Working Time Directive, the men in Brussels told us we had to. So we did it rather than recognising that there's an intrinsic problem with the way we deliver our healthcare at many different levels in Ireland. The European Working Time Directive and overworking junior health staff is one aspect of that problem, and you know, fixing it with a sticky plaster of saying, well, now we'll buy some more people from India to fill in the gaps for the Irish people that we've exported. I mean, that's not really a solution. A solution is to say, well, you know, what is the structure that we have, this very pyramidal hierarchical structure that we have in the country, where there's no real career progression in a way that might be in other Anglophone countries. What is it that we need to do to change that? And we've never really addressed that, partly because it's quite expensive to do that, because you're going to have to put money in, you know, more money than just buying a few NCHDs, but a real root and branch problem. And you can't be, you know, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. What's happened, like I said, is the infrastructure within the hospitals is catastrophically damaged as a result of this, because we can't put in clerical staff because there's no money in the hospitals, and now the hospitals and the HSC in general has to have found money to put in the NCHDs because the big boys in Brussels told we had
to. So Priscilla, if there are so many vacancies in NCHD roles, they're being filled presumably by locums. Some are being filled by candidates applying for posts, but is the quality of the candidate that's being appointed, has that deteriorated?
Well, the HSE will always claim that it hasn't and that safety first is their message. But to be fair to them, I was speaking to them yesterday and they said that there's approximately 4,910 NCHDs in our system at the moment. They have increased in the last couple of years in recognition of the European Working Time Directive.
Having reduced it
as well, because I do remember when there was 4,600 some years ago and they were trying to reduce it even further.
They actively suppressed posts. They actively told us that we couldn't, if we wanted to expand our consultant numbers, because we're still the lowest in Europe.
CHD posts
for every consultant post, it had to be cost neutral, even in the time when there was money in the system. So in order for us to generate new consultant posts, which we badly need, we had to suppress NCHD posts. And of course, that made the European Working Time Directive implementation almost impossible because we didn't change the structure of the system.
Because we needed more doctors across the board.
Exactly.
It's not,
there has been increased patient demand as well for services. But they've realised that they've increased the number of NCHDs. And I think the HSE has pointed out that 80% of the posts at the moment are structured training posts, which is an increase of 40% from 2007. And 113 new training posts have been created specifically for the July 2014 intake. I suppose my point is the HSE have said that they are trying to put in more structured posts, but there is a few questions. We've had some really good reports in recent years just about manpower training and how to structure the posts, but we never actually implement those findings, as Orla has said. The problem is as well, the HSE will say that they can only do so much. Is it policymakers really who need to step in here? And Liam, does the government actually need to take responsibility and actually sit down, have a meeting of, say, the joint Oireachtas Health Committee, for example, put together perhaps a number of suggestions that the minister himself can actually roll out? Because as we've seen with the medical card situation in recent days, we were told that there's nothing they could do, there was nothing wrong there. And all of a sudden, actually, there was a big backtrack. They were able to find the money from somewhere and put it in place. The health system is under huge financial pressure. The HSE is tied by that. But I think it is time, really, that policymakers looked at this issue in a broader sense and did come up with solutions and did order that they would be implemented.
There was a comment made by former Secretary General. He said that the urgent constantly conspires to push out the important in health. And I think that's what is essentially wrong. No matter, everything is important in health, but there's constantly urgent issues that crop up. You'd nearly want to split the Department of Health in two. One minister running the day-to-day affairs and another one planning for, like what you're talking about, for the future.
That's what the HSE and the Department of Health are supposed to do, respect.
But it doesn't happen.
Yes, one's supposed to implement policy, the other creation.
It doesn't happen. Yeah. Even a comment that one of the people who contributed there earlier was talking about how he gave the wrong medication. Mm-hmm. There's no need for a junior doctor to be giving IV antibiotics.
There's no need for that.
A nurse is well capable and professional enough to give antibiotics and take bloods and do a whole range of other things in general practice. When I'm in general practice 15 years, when I started, very few practice secretaries, no computerisation or very little of it, very few practice nurses. Now all of us are computerised practice secretaries and practice nurses. The practice nurses, the smears, the vaccinations, takes the bloods, whole range of stuff. Mm. Just hand it over to nurses.
Liam's right, task sharing.
In a hospital, when I go into the hospital now and I sit there in the outpatients and watch them pull the same trolleys through the hospitals full of medical records, you know, it hasn't changed very little in comparison to where the change could have been in that sort of 15 years. It could have been revolutionary, and a lot of the issues we're talking about may not even be discussed.
But that is a government policy issue because the generation of electronic patient records, I mean, you're right, it's ridiculous. In some hospitals, in Galway, for example, there are electronic patient records, but in many of the Dublin hospitals, everything is in paper held together with elastic bands. That is a government issue, though. That's a government policy issue of making the patient records electronic. That is a policy issue that could be implemented.
We all drive it, actually. Everybody who works in health, the same policies apply to primary care. And yet the GPs have absolutely changed the way they work because we are essentially independent contractors for the government and we have to change the way we go about our business. Whereas, so you can't just say it's government policy. And again, this goes back to what we talked about. It's either the frontline person who's made the mistake by giving the wrong injection or it's the government. And it's nobody in between. It's taking responsibility where in reality, everybody in the system needs to take responsibility because when everybody takes responsibility, there is drive for change. And you've seen this yourself in individual hospitals who are lucky enough to get a good board and and a good management structure, it's amazing what can be achieved when they actually just decide we're driving this forward. And it's not, and they don't need extra millions and billions. Mm-hmm. They just manage to do it.
We are light years behind the Irish health system in regards to electronic patient records and all that ICT in healthcare. A reason for I've actually been writing about electronic patient records for over 10 years that it was on the cusp of coming in and all this modernisation. This applies to even hospital pharmacists as well, who mm-hmm. use a DOS hospital computer mm-hmm. system, which is ridiculously mm-hmm. outdated. I mean, this is, goes back to the days of the 1980s, and it's quite dangerous. GPs have forged well ahead because they are independent contractors. They've realised that there's so much more that they can do with electronic patient records, and they have put them into their practices. The problem is the HSE's ICT strategies have not been implemented. Their budgets have been slashed. The whole PPAR scandal with HSE and payroll, that was really the nail in the coffin of the HSE's ICT strategy. They find it incredibly difficult to get money from the Department of Public Expenditure because of that. And recent plans have all been cut because of budget problems. But it's something they have to sit back and really modernise. Some public hospitals have managed to scrape together the funds and have, there's, I think, teleradiology and other areas which actually are very successful. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some really interesting projects in individual hospitals. And I know even in Beaumont, there's some good work there,
the
actually.
Epilepsy services and electronic patient records. But even, very successful.
And Priscilla, that would all have a knock-on effect. That would alleviate the workload.
It would alleviate workload. It would alleviate errors as well. It would make it easier for hospitals to talk to GPs, because there are some very good individual projects, HealthLink, for example, where they can send the GPs electronic results from their tests. But I was in a Dublin hospital recently myself, and that's exactly how Orla described it. I had my patient file, which had an elastic band around it, and it's paper, and I had quite an interesting look through it. But I just thought it's quite bizarre in this day and age.
Well, this goes back to the joined-up thinking. Jackie Jones, in the back of the Irish Times Health Supplement today, has a fabulous piece about why the health system doesn't work, and she uses an analogy of a hypermarket, supermarkets and small stores. It's worth reading. She used to work in the health
system. I do want to talk about the impact of all, because at the centre of all of this obviously is the patient, is the people who use the hospitals and who rely on people like you and Orla to help them get better when they come in. And Mary has texted in to say, where does the patient fit into a doctor's work-life balance? Patient safety is a huge issue. She had a family member who was a victim of an unprescribed dosage of medication over 4 days. Nobody seemed to be held responsible. Patients dread the influx of headless chickens on the wards. Is the current crisis having a direct impact on patient safety?
We've no data to say either way, but I think we'd have to be worried that if it goes unchecked, that there will be an implication for patient safety, particularly as we were saying, come July and the time when all the NCHDs move, and then when we realise how many places we have left vacant. We've already seen the situation in Limerick where small hospitals were closed, all their patients were diverted to the emergency department in Limerick without, it seems, a proportionate increase in the funding and staffing of the Limerick ED. And now we have the HICO report saying there's 37 patients on trolleys, and we already know from previous reports and from reports into TALA that that's an unsafe situation for patients.
So it is bound to have an effect, isn't it? I mean, things are bound to be missed. Checks are bound not to be made, and patients' lives are put at risk.
Well, we have as many checks and balances in place, or we have a lot of checks and balances in place, and for things like medication errors with hospital pharmacists and nursing staff, and the design of prescriptions in hospitals have got so much better even since I've started working. But it's something you'd be concerned about, to be sure.
Are you concerned about it, Orla?
I mean, I think, you know, medicine is a discipline where it's a huge privilege and a huge responsibility, and I think people who go into medicine do recognise that. Young doctors do recognise that. I think the issue around where does the patient sit in the system is actually a very prescient one, because I think if you look at the original design of the HSE, the patient actually is a little tiny dot at the end of these huge, big, monolithic structures, you know, and the new system of seven structures is quite similar. The patient doesn't actually figure at all. This sort of target approach that the HSE has taken is not patient friendly at all. For example, you have to have a certain number of new patients seen per month or per week or whatever. Your ratio of new to return has to meet a certain target. Where is the requirement for us to be able to recognise and value an individual patient if the patient is seen as a number and a target and we have to meet those targets? So obviously you have to have some level of efficiency within the system as well. There is a problem with joined up thinking. Did I say that before?
Once or twice.
But I think that, you know, the system does conspire against the compassionate doctor. There's no doubt about that. And we need to be really careful of that, because the reason why people went into medicine, the reason why I went in, and I'm sure Liam and Hugh, who are half a generation and probably three generations behind me, it's the same. People went into medicine because they wanted to help people. And there is a conspiracy against that. It's very difficult. You know, there's a talk in my profession and in neurology, and I do palliative care as well, is, you know, around compassion fatigue. Because, you know, if you're in the system that grinds you down, where your morale is continuously ground down, where you want to help and you can't, it's very difficult to keep the level of interest and integrity that you should have as a doctor. And we're not protecting that in a way that we should. But I think that's a structural problem within the HSE. I think that, you know, this idea of meeting targets, of delivering a certain, you know, a number and a ratio and a one size fits all approach is wrong, because it forgets that the people that we're serving are the people that are ill, and they are the people that's what should be in the centre of the system, and not me or you or the manager or anybody else. It should be the person who has the condition.
Do you agree, Liam, that is lacking?
I think it is lacking, and I think that's why we actually do need something like a patient safety authority that gives power back to the patient. But we also need to change the way we act within the health services. It's very adversarial. It's not. There's no way that we can have it. At the moment, you don't have the sort of no fault sort of way of reporting mistakes. You make a mistake, you're penalised. Whereas we're looking at 22 million GP consultations, 15 million hospital interactions per year. Of course there's mistakes. Of course things have gone wrong. Some of them are minor. Some of them are noticed. Some of them are not even noticed by the doctors or the patients themselves. So we have to just accept that this happens, because it's human nature dealing with human beings who are being treated by human beings. So we have to have a system in place that, first of all, gives some power back to the patient. And we also need to accept that when mistakes are made, that we learn by these mistakes, not that we just set out to penalise everyone involved, hush it all under the carpet.
But it seems time and time again that lessons aren't learned. How many times have we seen reports not implemented?
Because we're all so adversarial about it. If our airline industry acted the way we acted, there would be planes falling out of the sky every day. But they took a different approach to it. They said the pilots are not wrong. The pilots are not to be scapegoated. We need to do the same for our doctors and nurses. We need to say to them, look, guys, something happened here. What happened? Let's go through it. Let's learn from it. It's amazing if you did something like that and backed it up with a patient safety authority. Again, this has happened in other jurisdictions. The whole attitude changes within the health service.
But is it
just
the
not
case?
Become that us and them thing, like is really prevalent at the moment. It's all like a sort of system of silos. There's the consultants, there's the junior doctors, there's the nurses, there's the patients, there's the administrators. As if somehow we're all doing a different job, working in a different system. It doesn't dawn on anyone that we're actually all working together in the same system. What this we really do need our administrators to believe that they are as responsible as the doctors and nurses.
That's the key word, isn't it?
We're all working in the same system, but the system doesn't resolve around the key party within the system, which is the person who's seeking the medical care. And that's actually the biggest problem that we have. The way our system should be structured is that the person with the illness should be in the middle and everything else should be around it, not in this sort of hierarchical structure where the person's at the bottom. But to do that,
we need to break all the hierarchies. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have the consultant who comes in and said that, because that's what I do, and that's because I said
absolutely.
So.
And
Liam mentioned doctors don't want to feel scapegoated, but then he said about responsibility. Isn't that key as well? Doctors have to take responsibility.
No, without doubt, and that's what we heard in those clips you played earlier. You know, if something goes wrong and you feel that you might be, that's something that you could alleviate, or that it's from a mistake.
But
how
often do we hear about court battles going on for years and years and years because the HSE and the hospitals do not take responsibility?
But and part of it is that if international studies would show, you know, if you would admit responsibility straight up or say, listen, something's happened and we're going to fix it now, but we're going to tell you about it, and that's the culture of no fault reporting. I've seen it in some cases that I have worked with some consultants who we'd have a near miss. We'd say, actually, you know, you didn't do something right there. So, we've caught it now, but let's all sit down and figure out how did that happen.
Yes, but that goes back to the time pressure that I was talking about. I mean, there's no downtime within our system. There are a couple of problems. There's no downtime for anybody. We're under these massive pressure to meet targets. And there's no time, there's no value placed on time to sit down and reflect. We don't have any system within, we don't have a structure within our systems at the moment to permit reflection, and that's really important part of what we do.
We need to build that in and make it a core part, as opposed to something you add on. If you're
not really valued at the moment in the structures that we have, you know, we're seeing too many. I mean, if you look at, for example, the number of patient encounters that we have in the hospital system They're way above what the recommended safety level is in all of the other Anglophone and Europe non-Anglophone countries as well. We see far more patients than the people in neurology in the UK or in mainland Europe, or in the US or in Australia or New Zealand, and that's true for all the specialties. So if we see that many patients, we see far more patients than we should. We get very good clinically. We get fast. We get a little bit cold. We get a little bit, you know, that affects morale as well, and it affects our ability to reflect. So you know, these are. Massive structural problems in the system, and part of that has to do with the way we have our system designed, in that it's very hospital centric.
Yeah, and Priscilla, is it difficult without that data to decide if or not this lack of junior doctors, this all the problems that we've discussed so far, is directly impacting on patient safety?
Yes, actually, Health Minister James Reilly last year published open disclosure guidelines for hospitals and the health system to try and encourage them to come forward and admit mistakes to patients and try and work through it. I don't think there's been enough focus on that, or that has it really been implemented throughout the health system.
There's no time. That's the problem, as
Orla said. But personally, actually, I have seen a case in a Dublin hospital where they do tackle those type of problems up front. And the consultant, actually the head consultant of the hospital, does meet patients where there have been near misses and mistakes and talks to them. And it seems to work very well. But I've also seen another hospital further down the country where there was complete denial of actually overdosing a patient, and a family member actually said it to me. And that creates huge distrust and anger. And as you've pointed out, a lot of the cases that are before the courts, patients aren't chasing for money. They just want acknowledgement and an apology and someone to be held accountable. And I think to ensure it doesn't happen again. And that's what we've been hearing over and over again. The State Claims Agency has pointed this out a number of times. So there really needs to be a lot more effort put into that. And also for doctors who make an innocent mistake due to time pressures or the system itself, to feel that they can actually be honest and learn from the mistake. Though for those who make a serious mistake where it is their fault, to be held accountable by the Medical Council.
Okay, we're going to take a break now, but we're going to continue the discussion. I'll just read a text before we go to the break, because we'll talk about it after the break. It's from Pat. I think Professor Hardiman's assumption that everyone who goes into medicine does so to help people is unlikely to be correct. Might money and prestige not be a significant factor? How many of them had nursing anywhere on their CAO forms, I wonder? And we're going to talk about pay after this break. And you're very welcome back to the programme. You're listening to Late Debate. We're discussing our health service again, and we're broadcasting live for the very first time on RTE News Now. That's on your television, so you can have a look at us if you want. And our panel tonight, Professor Orla Hardiman, consultant neurologist at Beaumont Hospital in Dublin, NCHD Hugh Adler, who's based at the Mater Hospital, Fine Gael TD Dr Liam Toomey, who's a GP, and medical writer Priscilla Lynch. And before the break, we brought up the subject of pay, thanks to Pat on the text. And Orla Hardiman, is consultants' pay, it has been cut, and the pay levels of new consultants coming in is also much less than existing consultants. Is that a deterrent as well?
Absolutely, it's a deterrent. One of the things that we forget in Ireland is that you know, we work in a system that's really badly broken. The infrastructure is horrible. It's not a great place to work if you particularly if you've trained abroad. And traditionally, the ways that we had attracted people from countries to which they'd emigrated, myself included, was that, you know, that you compensated for the horrible work conditions by remunerating people. We are competing with the Anglophone world. We're not competing with Finland or Germany or Holland. We're competing with other countries that speak English. And in other countries that speak English, the salary scales are higher and the work-life balance is better. Even in the UK, where the starting salary for a consultant is commensurate with the starting salary now, the working conditions are vastly superior, and the potential for career advancement as a young consultant is much higher, even in the difficulties that the NHS finds itself now, because there are many problems within the NHS. So it's just not an attractive place to come back, and one of the ways that we have traditionally attracted people to come back may not work in the future either, has been to offer a reasonable remuneration in a country where the standard of living, the cost of living is actually commensurately higher. We have to pay for schooling. We have to pay, well, most people who come back will find that they will have to look at schooling. They have to pay for private health insurance. So the sorts of things that you would get in countries like the UK, for example, you have to pay for here. So the cost of living is considerably higher. And there are many people who've looked to come back, and Priscilla probably has the data on this, and have run away because the work environment is so horrible and the remuneration just doesn't actually compensate for that.
And yet, Priscilla, you know, we're talking at least 110,000, I think, for a consultant's salary, and then the prospect of, it seems, endless private work if necessary.
That's actually not true anymore either.
No, actually, it's roughly about 116,000, but there's lots of different variations. So it's hard to give one figure because we have a huge amount of pay scales actually in the health service. But I suppose we should just reflect that it was a 30% cut the end of 2012 following a kind of a big standoff between the Minister James Riley and consultants. And at the time, he said he didn't see it affecting posts. Consultants warned it would. And what they weren't, it would happen, has come to pass.
And did every consultant take a 30% pay cut?
No, this was for new entrants. So new, we've created a two-tier system where the original consultants have taken pay cuts under the various public sector pay deals, but the new consultants took quite a cut so that they could be doing the same job as another consultant who's a couple of years ahead of them at much lesser pay, 50 grand less, actually, roughly, to give a figure. It depends on where you're working.
But does that apply with a consultant who has years of experience in another country coming to work here?
It does. Yes. And this is something that, actually,
even at a professorial, at an academic level. So, for example, we have quite a few vacant senior teaching and research and academic posts in Ireland that we just haven't been able to fill because of the cuts. There's been a significant cut at that level as well. And, you know, you can argue it is extremely good money, and it's way, way, way above, you know, the natural average pay, and there's no doubt about that. But you know, if we want to attract people back, that's what we're going to have to pay. There's no way around that. You're not going to attract people back.
But what about the private work? That. Because that perception is still there that you can do as much private work as you want.
That's just not correct. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's just not correct. The vast majority of people who are my age, and I'm in my mid-50s now, my age and younger, are committed, who work in the public system are committed to their public work. And the new contracts make it even more difficult for people to work privately.
But no one's monitoring the amount of public
hours.
The
HSE actually is monitoring that.
Have they tightened their monitoring then? Because they hadn't been monitoring to any great extent or sanctioning.
The hospitals are monitoring that. It's quite difficult because of the workload and because the requirement for these targets that I mentioned earlier. It's quite difficult for consultants to skive off and not do their public work. Because also, you know, nowadays we work more or less in groups. You know, most, and certainly the major teaching hospitals, is more than one specialist in the same area. So you're working with a team of other consultants generally. And it's very difficult, you know. It wouldn't be possible for one consultant to not carry the load. They would incur the wrath of their colleagues if that were the case. So I think that's a myth that we need to explode. In the past, when I started, it was, you know, when I was a young doctor, you know, you would not see the consultant from one end of the week to the other.
That's the image.
Well,
they
come in for, they mostly were men, and a lot of them had three-piece suits, you know, but you know, they would come in and do a short ward round. You know, there were exceptions, but there was some people, a proportion of people were like that. But that, I think that's a myth that has been propagated.
Is it a myth, Priscilla?
Well, just explain, I suppose, about the different types of contracts, because it can be very confusing for people listening at home. Under the new contract 2008, Type A contracts are public only. There's currently 502 of those in the system. Type B allows 20% private practice within the public hospital itself. So that's 1,492 contracts. Then there's Type B Star, they can do some teaching. Professors, for example, there's 300 of those. They have limited private practice
as well.
But
they're not being implemented. The Type B Star is an old
category. It's an old one, but there's about 300 of those. And there's Type C then, which is a very rare type of contract under the new one. That's where that they can do private and public work, but the private work can be carried out outside their public hospital. There's also nearly 400 on the older contracts. A lot of them would be what people would be familiar with, where they could do a lot of private work. So the HSE, when they bought in the new contract, really wanted to clamp down on this private work outside the public hospitals, understandably, and wanted more dedication to patients. I think, though, what has happened, though, is that's made it very hard then to attract the cream of the crop really back over to Ireland with the limits on their public practice. There's some interesting wars really going on between the HSE and certain public hospitals, like St Vincent's, for example, who has a private hospital on its campus and who claim that its consultants who are on these Type B contracts can also work in the private hospital because it's on the same campus. So there is actually some rows between the HSE. There is compliance issues as well. Obviously, obviously with the 80-20%. But I think some consultants have pointed out that they work in very rare specialties, particularly in paediatrics, and they can't just cut off at exactly 20% and go, well, tough luck, you're going to have to wait for another 3 years even though you've health insurance, because even though there's no one else in the country who can see you.
Well, so we need to divide again, also against between whether you do procedures or not, and that they know whether you're a surgeon or a physician. Mm-hmm. We have to remember that even now, 41% of people in Ireland have private health insurance.
47%.
Well, so and 80% of hospital admissions in public hospitals come in through A&E. Mm-hmm. So 40% of 80% means that that percentage of people will have private health insurance. And so even if, for example, I, who don't have a private practice except for a couple of hours one day a week, don't practice outside of Beaumont, I look like I might be doing, if I have four admissions and two of them have private health insurance, that automatically is clocked as 50% private practice. But those patients get exactly the same care, whether they're public or private.
Liam Toomey, do you accept that cutting the consultants' pay, it was a very popular thing to do at the time, but it has had an impact on the quality of consultants and the number of consultants who want to work here?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, I think it has. I think we can see that now, that it is making a difference. But, you know, some of the issues that we've been talking about here, there is always a small minority of people who abuse every single position. And this is open to abuse, what we're talking about here, with consultants working in private practice and public practice. It's open to abuse. But there's only a small number of people who do it. I deal with a huge number of consultants, like what you're talking about, because Wexford now, we're linking in now a lot with St. Vincent's. And I can always get the consultants that I really need for the public patient. So I think we shouldn't demonise the consultants working private practice so quickly. The vast majority of them really do a fantastic job in the public sector. And I think that's where we should put our focus in, is watching and seeing what they're doing in the public sector. And that's down to the hospital administrators. That's down to what we talk about, this deficit in figures and deficit in real management in our hospitals. And then we know what consultants are doing, and we could break down that. But it's just so easy sometimes to sort of blame people, as demonise the consultant in private practice, demonise the person who's the administrator. You know, the way we talk about the administrator in HSE, as if they were made in a factory in China and brought in here. You know, they are as much a divergent group as the consultants and as the nurses and as the junior doctors are. They are someone who are fantastic and someone who are plain useless and should be thrown out of their jobs.
Liam, this goes back to an issue of policy and leadership, and that's what really we've been lacking all along within our system, ever since I've been in the system.
Because we always think that the only ones who have responsibility are the frontline people and the minister.
There's a difference between responsibility and accountability. That's the problem.
That's true, I agree.
The person who's responsible also has to be accountable, and the person who's accountable has to be responsible. And we have a difficulty in that regard. Mm. As you say, the administrators are responsible but not accountable. They're supposed to implement the changes, but they can't be held accountable because many of the changes that have to happen are beyond the scope by which they can work. So this is a structural leadership problem within the entire health sector, which you can trace all the way back to, you know, many, many different ministers. But it's a perennial problem. It needs very strong policy leadership within health, and it needs very strong executive leadership in whatever iteration that we have with respect to executive, currently the HSE, which is about to be abolished. So, and we have never really allowed any system to bed down and grow and have that sort of relationship where there's a decent policy, because we've also changed our policy over the years. We had a policy, you know, originally of a sort of a tax-based public health system. Then we had a policy under the Fianna Fáil Progressive Democrat government of privatisation. So there was a policy of privatisation, but there was an executive that had to drive a public system. So there was a massive mismatch between policy and executive during the first decade of this century.
I want to bring in Hugh on the pay issue. Is it a deterrent pay, Hugh, the pay? Because people are making the point that graduates, medical graduates, have huge loans, and this money is not necessarily a great incentive at all.
That's government policy has dictated that, and rightly so, that we should have more programs dedicated to graduate medical education. People who already have degrees already in the workforce then coming back to do medicine, but they have to pay for those degrees. They're coming out with debts of $100,000 and having to pay those back, and that's in common with medical graduates around the world. But that's why hospital consultant salaries need to be commensurate with paying those back.
And what do you think of the suggestion that has been made in recent times that because of the cost to the taxpayer of educating doctors, they should be obliged to give a couple of years service to hospitals in Ireland before they leave?
Well, virtually, and as in everyone that I know, everyone that I went to college with and everyone I know in other colleges does a year of internship in Irish hospitals after graduating. And as I said, even though so many people are immigrating, but you know, people tend to come back, and many people would work for a number of years in the Irish system before heading abroad. So I don't think that that's going to be the fix-all solution. Because when it comes down to salaries, let's not forget that I spent 6 years in medical school, and then I've done 3 years postgraduate training. I'm looking at least 8 more years postgraduate training plus PhD plus time abroad before I'll have any side.
But A&E consultant Chris Luke this morning was saying that our education system trains doctors to work in our hospitals, not to work for yourselves in other hospitals.
But our hospital system is very much guided towards exporting doctors, and the fact that we're looking to, as we discussed earlier, bring in doctors from developing countries, but countries that need those doctors, rather than putting career structures in place that would retain our own graduates.
We won't
close the medical school in Ireland either and divert those funds into proper postgraduate education either. And I'm sure if I went down to Chris Luke and closed UCC's medical school, he'd have a different opinion about what he's saying too.
Okay. We've about 7 minutes left, but at this point I want to bring in our regular contributor to Late Debate, the comedian and author Colm O'Regan. He's been thinking about our health service and he has a few questions.
Warning, this column will achieve next to nothing. I'll mention my interactions with the health service. These are statistically insignificant. I'll repeat some of the received wisdoms about the health service. I'll mention how foreigners are doing it much better abroad. All I'll do is ask a few really stupid questions at the end. If it doesn't add anything to the debate, I'll have kept you for approximately 2 minutes, giving you a chance to boil the kettle or nip to the loo. I had two experiences with the health service recently. One was wonderful, sensitive, empathetic, professional care in a difficult situation. On the other hand, some relatives in their 80s had to wait 8.5 hours in an emergency room to be seen, and 8.5 hours doesn't even constitute a horror story. And of course, anecdotally, not statistically significantly, talking to others, that seems to be a familiar experience. Excellent care when you get it, and awful waiting times before you get there. We've no money to make it better, we're told. Well, what are they doing abroad? Try New Zealand, for example. Its population is 97% that of Ireland, so it's a bit like Ireland. Their health budget is 9 billion euro. What an awful place it must be, except their life expectancy is a little higher than ours. So here's a stupid question. How do they manage to spend 4.5 billion less and still live as long? You'd put up with it if you thought the situation was getting better. It doesn't seem to be. We're told now that the HSE deficit is heading for 500 million euro. Here's a stupid question. Why don't they include a deficit in their estimates? As long as I can remember, I've been hearing the words HSE and deficit in the same news headline. So if a deficit is all that's going to happen, why not just plan for it? And once they've got that monkey off their backs, here's another stupid question. Is there any chance at all we could get a proper, honest idea of how much things cost in the health service? I feel like saying to Minister Riley, OK, I'm not going to be angry, just tell me, do you know how much that measure is going to cost or save? Honestly, do you know? If you don't, that's fine, just tell me. Another question I'd love to know the answer to, is it cheaper to train overworked doctors and underpaid nurses and then have them emigrate rather than hire enough doctors and pay the new nurses a living wage? Is it? Just be honest with us. Expectations are so low we'd nearly take any bad news at this stage. And here's the stupidest question of all, is there any way at all we could take the politics out of health? How about no more election promises about health being made in the heat of battle and then grimly stuck to because reputations are attached to them? If we can have consensus about bailouts, troikas and bank guarantees, why can't we have it about health? OK, I've kept you waiting long enough. The panel will see you now.
Thank you, Colm. No chance of politics being taken out of health, is there, Priscilla?
No, life wouldn't be as exciting, I don't think, if it was, to be perfectly honest. But just a very quick update on the whole consultant pay issue. As we said, the 30% cut at the end of 2012, it's stifling applicants for posts. At the moment now, we're struggling to get even one application for a lot of senior posts, whereas 5 to 10 years ago, there used to be 5+ of excellent quality.
16 applied for the job I got.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And now, I mean, you'd struggle probably to attract one. But the interesting thing is the HSE has acknowledged the problem. Tony O'Brien wrote the department earlier this year asking for higher pay scales for those who had long-term experience. But there's been two LRC meetings between the IMO and the government just about these pay scales under Haddington Road. And it is, and they've been described as useful with the IMO. There's another meeting this Thursday as well. And I think the pressure is on there. So it looks like there will be some sort of a row back there. I'm sure, though, it'll be done in a way that will be seen as politically not giving in and rowing back. But, you know, as a way to address the problem. But we have a member of government here tonight as well who admitted that it has been a bad move, which is refreshing to see that, you know, there's acknowledgement that there is a problem there for that. There's also actually an intern conference coming up, and the results of a survey that they've done indicates that 80% of interns, that's doctors who've just graduated medical school and have done 1 year working in the Irish health system, 80% of them this July intend to emigrate. So we really need to do something about that.
When you think that 80% of our undergraduates who are of the finest quality trained doctors don't want to be here as postgraduate doctors.
Are you planning on staying, Hugh, or do you intend to leave?
I'm going away for 1 year, but then I will come back, and I have a 5-year training contract starting in July 2015.
Where are you going?
Haven't fully nailed it down. I want to go somewhere in Africa, do some tropical medicine.
Okay.
And then going to come and train here for 5 years. And after that, it's anyone's guess, to be honest. You know, I've spoken to so many people.
The system will be fixed when I get a job.
Well, that's why I'm going away for a year. When I come back, it'll all be perfect. So I'll see you 2015, guys. But 5 years from now, if more consultant posts become open and, you know, it's feasible to work in Ireland, that'd be great. But realistically, I'll be looking at a period in purgatory abroad, at least.
You could also get a GP job. We're supposed to have free GP care for everybody by 2016, but there's a mass exodus of experienced GPs as well as trainee GPs. So I think we're going to need anyone on board at that stage to provide this particular care. Mm. Though pharmacists are chomping at the bit to help out, so I think there might be some creative thinking on behalf of the government.
It's creative thinking has happened in general practice in the last 50 years to a remarkable degree.
The question about cost, that's a huge issue. We don't actually know what anything costs in the health system. It's absolutely shocking. There, in the early 2000s, the Department of Health had no health economist at all. We have one or two now around, but we have a terrible handle on how much health costs. Mm. And that allows a lot of waste.
That's why there's such an overrun as well.
I think that comment was a very pressing comment.
Absolutely. Well, just to finish on a couple of texts. This is from a hospital consultant who says they're about to leave this dysfunction behind because they say, I keep asking if harm is coming to the patients. And this consultant says, absolutely yes, every day and in every hospital. Any other answer is denial. Well, that is it from us on Late Debate. We hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Professor Orla Hardiman, Dr. Liam Toomey, Dr. Hugh Adler and Priscilla Lynch. Back at 10 tomorrow night. Until then, from everyone on the team, good night.